thank the organizers for putting together this interesting meeting. Like, it is, it's satisfying to see so many people also kind of grasping towards the right models and the right questions to be asking in the field of relativistic quantum information, because as somebody who has struggled myself to marry these two passions of quantum information and relativity, I know how hard it can be. And so seeing, I've learned a lot over the last week. Of course, speaking about marriage, my talk today is going to be about the mating habits of mutual information in holographic field theories. And it's a little bit, I guess, a little bit different than what has been discussed for the most part during this conference, but brings together these two, the ideas of relativity and quantum information in a different way, and hopefully make some interesting statements. So I'll start off by just reviewing the Ryu Takayanagi formula, or conjecture, really, for how one calculates entanglement entropy in holographic field theories. And then I'll just move on to looking at basic properties of the mutual information, both abstractly and in general field theory, so we can get a feel for what might be possible and what we can expect, and then move on to the consequences of this Ryu Takayanagi formula in the special case that a theory is holographic. And it's going to imply some very interesting special properties for the behavior of mutual information, which implies that there's something interesting going on with the structure of correlation in these theories. And that's going to allow us to both get some new checks on the consistency of the conjecture and potentially to learn something about what kinds of field theories can have holographic duals. And then I'll move on to thinking a little bit about possible generalizations. I guess I'll indicate to you how you prove this non-rigorously and ultimately rigorously, and I'll end with a conjecture that hopefully someone energetic in the audience will attack and answer for us. All right, so you don't have to know very much about the ADS-CFT correspondence to listen to this talk. I didn't know very much about the ADS-CFT correspondence to do the research, and so you shouldn't need to know any more than I do. But the basic picture is important. And the idea is that string theory in a D plus one dimensional space-time that is asymptotically anti-de Sitter, but not necessarily anti-de Sitter deep inside, is equivalent to a quantum field theory living on the boundary of that asymptotically anti-de Sitter space. And the conjecture is actually that the partition functions of these two theories are the same. And that's interesting because the bulk theory, the one inside, is a D plus two dimensional theory, whereas the theory on the boundary is a D plus one dimensional theory. And so this is really a concrete realization of the idea of holography that's come up a few times during the workshop already. And the first example was this this equivalence that that was found between two theories that I don't know very much about, but type 2B string theory on ADS 5 cross a five-dimensional sphere and supersymmetric N equals 4 Yang-Mills. One of them is a string theory, the other one is a just a quantum field theory living on the boundary. So that's the picture. And then we're going to be talking about specifically entanglement entropy. And I think all of you know what entanglement entropy is, but if you have some density operator, the entanglement entropy is just minus the trace of rho log rho of that density operator. So in particular, we're going to be looking at entanglement entropies for regions in the boundary field theory. And so we'll talk about static space-times only, so we'll just work in a time slice. So I guess relativity is mostly gone at this point, but we will, it's sort of lurking in the background. So this is a depiction of the spatial part of the boundary, and we're just going to cut out a region A, right? So this is a spatial region, and so there's a density operator associated with A. It could be that the boundary field theory is in the ground state, it could be in a thermal state, some other state, but we trace over a bunch of degrees of freedom, and we almost certainly get some mixed state, rho A. The Ryu Takayanagi proposal for how you calculate the entanglement entropy of this state is very beautiful. I mean, it's quite a remarkable thing. The proposal is that up to some constant, this entanglement entropy is the minimum over some class of surfaces of the area of some surface. Right? So if you've ever actually tried to calculate an entanglement entropy in field theory or in a condensed matter system, these are brutal calculations involving diagonalizing, you know, complicated systems. This is just a totally geometrical formula. Right? You calculate the area of something. And what do you calculate the area of? Well, you look at regions in the bulk, or surfaces in the bulk, that are homologous to the boundary. So one way of thinking about that is you just think of regions in the bulk such that they're their boundary in the CFT part is A, and then their boundary inside the bulk is something else that I'll call gamma A. And you just look at the area of gamma A. Then you minimize over all such surfaces. And so this proposal for the formula is just that it's the area of a minimal surface. What is the evidence for this? Well, quite remarkably, at least in ADS3 cross two-dimensional CFTs, so really the spatial part of the CFT is one-dimensional, you get precise agreement right up to the constant out front. And this is really quite a remarkable thing. And it works not just in the case of the ground state of the field theory, but in a thermal state as well. And in the case of the thermal state, the corresponding bulk geometry actually has a black hole in it. So these are non-trivial calculations that actually give you the same, you know, two very different looking calculations, one coming from the field theory, one just calculating some geometrical quantity, they give you the same answer. What else can you do? You can try to look at whether or not this formula satisfies the key properties that von Neumann entropy is supposed to satisfy, entanglement entropy. And the key property, you know, the basic property of the von Neumann entropy is strong subadditivity. So Hedrick, back in 2007, along with Takayanagi, showed that this prescription will always lead to a formula that satisfies strong subadditivity. Here at Perimeter, well, I guess Horatio Cassini may or may not be in the audience, so Rob Myers is around. They proved that if this region A is spherical, then actually the formula will always work. And so these are quite non-trivial checks, and there's more stuff that has been done. Okay, so that's the starting point. So this talk is going to be just examining formal properties of this Ryu Takayanagi formula and its consequences. And I'm going to focus specifically on mutual information. And mutual information, as I'm sure all of you know, but we'll just review, it's this particular linear combination of entropies. If you have subsystems A and B, entropy of A plus entropy of B minus the joint entropy. You can think of it in terms of a Venn diagram. If the circle on the left is the entropy of A, circle on the right is the entropy of B, the whole shape is the entropy of AB, so the region in the middle, which is double counted, is the mutual information. So what's to like about the mutual information? As an information theorist, there are two things that I really like. One, it's zero if and only if the state is a product state. So it detects all possible correlations that that exist in a state. So if you choose some particular observables and you evaluate a two-point correlation function on a given state, you may or may not detect the correlations that are there. Mutual information always detects all the correlations. But it also has an operational interpretation. So as an information theorist, for me, that's really important. One of my favorite ones, in the interest of sharing, I'll just briefly describe, that if you have some density operator rho AB, and you look at many copies of it, you could ask how many bits of noise have to be injected into rho AB in order to destroy all the correlations that are there. Turns out that answer, that number of bits, is controlled by the mutual information. So formally, if I apply a unitary indexed by K on the A system, and then I forget which unitary was applied, that's a way of injecting noise. And the number of different unitaries I choose, the log of that number of unitaries defines the number of bits of noise I've injected. And so if you require that the final state is close to product, and you optimize over all possible choices of unitaries, what you find is the number of unitaries per copy of row in the best possible way of eliminating the correlations tends to the mutual information. And I guess, a message that I like to drive home a lot of, when I talk to people who are perhaps not information theorists, is that in quantum information, the mutual information often tends to characterize how hard it is to get rid of correlations. It only very rarely characterizes how many correlations you can get out. So it's not necessarily how useful the correlations are in a state. It's sort of how many are there in some absolute sense. All right, so for a field theorist, what would a field theorist like about the mutual information? Well, one thing is that it cancels at least some of the ultraviolet divergences that exist in the entanglement entropy. So if you think of A and B as being spatial regions, and there's, an area law for the entanglement entropy, the area law tends to be divergent. It depends on the ultraviolet cutoff. These terms here, you'll have the area of the A part, the area of the B part, and if A and B are disjoint regions, then you'll subtract them off again. And so you'll cancel those ultraviolet divergences, at least those ones, so that's something to like. And it also gives you a general upper bound on any two-point correlation function. So in particular, there's a very old inequality called the quantum Pinsker inequality that tells us that if you try to evaluate the connected correlator, there's an upper bound on how large that can be and is bounded by the mutual information. So that's sort of a general purpose tool that relates this information theoretic quantity to the kind of thing that field theorists are more likely to calculate. Okay, so we looked at mutual information, kind of defined it in terms of this Venn diagram. If two was good, then three must be better, right? So here is the Venn diagram for three regions, three subsystems, and I can define, I'll call it the three-way mutual information by just doing the same thing. I'm interested in the overlap region in the center. So the singles minus the doubles plus the triples to make sure that I handle the double and triple counting properly. So there's a simple identity relating that sum of entropies to mutual informations. And in particular, this three-way mutual information will be the mutual information of A with B plus the mutual information of A with C minus the mutual information of A with BC. What does that mean? Well, it means that this three-way mutual information is a measure of the extensivity of mutual information, right? Because if mutual information were extensive, then the mutual information with B plus the mutual information with C would be equal to the mutual information with BC. That's sort of what we might mean by extensive. In general, though, it is not. So let's see what can happen just by looking at the simplest possible example, which is three correlated bits. So here I have the density operator of three. You can just think of it as classical bits. They're either all zero or all one, each with probability a half. So they're perfectly correlated. How do these mutual informations work out? Well, the A bit is perfectly correlated with the B bit, so there's one bit of mutual information there. Likewise for A with C. But A with BC, it's still just one bit, because it doesn't matter if I have B and C together or B and C or just B alone, because I could have made C from B, right? They're exactly the same. And so if I calculate this three-way mutual information, its value is 1 plus 1 minus 1 is exactly equal to 1. So it's subextensive in this case, mutual information. But let's look at a slightly more complicated kind of distribution. And here we have the equal mixture of all sequences of three bits that have an even number of ones in them. So either no ones or any of the possible places where there can be two ones. And if you look at A with B, with one quarter probability it's 0, 0, one quarter 0, 1, one quarter 1, 0, and one quarter 1, 1. So it's just a random pair of bits, right? There's no mutual information there at all. But if you look at A with BC together, if A is a 0, then you know that BC has to have even parity. Whereas if A is a 1, you know that BC has to have odd parity. So there's actually one bit of mutual information lurking in there. And that means that this I3 is 0, 0, minus 1 is minus 1. And so in this case, mutual information is super extensive. And what this means is that this I3 function, it's kind of measuring for us how redundant correlations are. Like in the first case, where the mutual information was subextensive, the correlations were very redundant, right? We were just repeating the same thing over and over again. Whereas in the second case, for tau, the correlations, there's more than the sum of its parts when you look at BC, right? If you looked at B alone or C alone, then you don't get as much as if you looked at B and C together. And so there's some kind of non-redundancy in the correlations. And in quantum information theory, we tend to refer to this as monogamy, and I'll come back to why it's called monogamy later in the talk. So just a little look to get a sense of what can happen if we think about just general field theories. The basic story is that anything is possible as far as this extensivity is concerned. That even just in a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT, if you look at the smallest scaling dimension, whether the theory is subextensive, extensive, or superextensive for the mutual information depends on whether that scaling dimension is less than a half, or greater than a half. For a 1 plus 1 dimensional massive fermion, it turns out that it matters whether you're thinking about mutual informations of regions and separations that are smaller than the Compton wavelength or larger than the Compton wavelength, so it can go either way. And then the last example is particularly interesting. In 2 plus 1 dimensions with a massive theory, this I3 function, the three-way mutual information, at least for a particular configuration of regions, is what Kataev and Preskill and also Levin and Wen called the topological entanglement entropy. And it measured some properties of the topological sector of the theory, And it was, and they found there was all, it always had the same sign, zero if there was no topological order, and strictly less than zero if there was. And that's kind of the example par excellence of non-extensivity of the mutual information, right? That in a, if there's topological order, when you look locally, you don't see any correlations at all. And only when you look at very large subsystems do you start to see those correlations, right? So that's just to give you a sense that, in general, field theories, anything is possible. But now let's focus on these holographic field theories with the Ryu Takayanagi prescription. So let's just see if we can make some sense of this I3 function. So on the right, I'm going to draw a graphical depiction of the terms that appear with positive sign in the three-way mutual information. So associated with the boundary region A, there's a minimal surface gamma A, right? So the bulk, the boundary is that the blue line that's horizontal, and the bulk is just what comes down below. With B, there's also a minimal surface, and with C, there's a minimal surface. And then with the ABC interval that I've drawn, there's also a minimal surface. So there are four of them. All right, what about the terms that appear with negative sign? Let's look at, let's actually start with AC because it's the most interesting one. One surface associated with AC is this one here, right? There's a particular surface associated with AC, the one gamma A union gamma C, right? That would be one surface that terminates on AC and penetrates into the bulk. But here's another one, right? There's a connected surface also. And what happens is if the B part, that interval between, is small enough, then the area of this surface is smaller than the one that I described previously. And so let's just work under the assumption that that's the case this time. And then associated with AB, there will be a surface, and BC, there's a surface. So I have something on the left, something on the right, and my goal is actually going to prove that in holographic field theories, the mutual information is always extensive. So I'm going to try to prove that the left is at least as big as the right-hand side, right? So this sum is at least as big as that sum. Well, what can I do? I can notice that gamma B appears on both sides. So does gamma ABC. So I can just ignore those two. And then I'm going to cut up the surfaces on the left and reorganize them. So there's cutting up and reorganizing the surfaces on the left. So now gamma prime A, which is composed of part of gamma AB and part of gamma BC, is a surface that terminates on A, right, and penetrates into the bulk, but it may not be the minimal surface. Gamma A over here is the minimal surface. This is some other surface, right? So because it's not necessarily minimal, its area doesn't have to be, its area could be larger. And likewise for this gamma C prime. And so these, I've reorganized the areas associated with the sum of the entropy of AB, BC, and AC into some other surfaces that satisfy the same hypotheses as what's required on the right without necessarily being minimal. And so the left-hand side is at least as big as the right-hand side. This is a pretty easy proof, right? Like, as compared to actually diagonalizing giant density operators or something, this is a pretty straightforward way to deal with entanglement entropies. So there's our conclusion. Holographic mutual information is monogamous, assuming that you, or is super extensive, assuming that this Ryu Takayanagi formula is correct. Well, what are the consequences of this? The main consequence is that the Ryu Takayanagi formula, while there have been some checks on it, it's very much a conjecture, right? So we can use this to actually verify, try to check some consistency of Ryu Takayanagi. And so let's start with just the strong subadditivity. This had been verified previously, but it's the easiest one to think about. So the strong subadditivity inequality for the von Neumann entropy is just what I've written down up there. It's easy to, if you've seen it enough times, it's easy to remember. If you haven't seen it enough times, it's easy to forget. But that's what it is. And the superextensivity inequality that we proved was that the two guys were bigger than or equal to the sum of the threes and the ones, right? So I've just moved one of the twos over to the right-hand side, so there's a minus sign. And this particular combination, entropy of A plus entropy of C minus entropy of AC, is a mutual information, right? And we all know that mutual information is non-negative, equal to zero if and only if there are no correlations between A and C. And so, boom, we've actually proved strong subadditivity, And in fact, it's very clear that we proved something significantly stronger, because we get a quantitative lower bound on the difference that we're interested in for strong subadditivity. So that was known previously, but there are less known about the quantum or the von Neumann entropy, or well, I guess I can fill in. There are actually very few inequalities known for the von Neumann entropy. That if you start investigating this in detail, I mean, people use all kinds of different inequalities, but at the end of the day, the only thing that was known until a few years ago was that there was strong subadditivity, and there was some variant of strong subadditivity you got by playing around with a purification. And that's it. Like, everything we knew about von Neumann entropy in terms of its inequalities was, could be summarized by those statements. But these days, there are actually a few more. So let's test the new ones. For that, it's convenient to define the conditional mutual information, which is just the quantity which is greater than or equal to zero when you talk about strong subadditivity. And strong subadditivity was the statement that this conditional mutual information was greater than or equal to zero. As we saw on the previous slide, superextensivity is the same thing as saying that this conditional mutual information is larger than the normal mutual information. So a few years ago, Linden and Winter found the following kind of nutty, or I don't know if it's nutty, but counterintuitive inequality. It's a constrained inequality for the von Neumann entropies. And it goes like this. If it's an inequality for four subsystems, and if three conditional mutual informations are zero, then a particular pair of mutual information satisfy an inequality. I don't have a very good intuitive understanding of what this means, and no one has ever used it for any practical purpose. But it's just a proof of principle that there's more out there than just what we know so far. That it's possible to construct functions that are consistent with strong subadditivity while violating this, for example. So let's see what superextensivity has to say about this. Well, one of the constraints is that the conditional mutual information between B and C, given D, is zero. But by superextensivity, that's larger than or equal to the mutual information between B and C. So the mutual information between B and C is zero. But now, if we look at the mutual information between A, B, and C, which is what we're interested in, there's a trivial identity called the chain rule that allows us to express it in terms of the mutual information of B with C plus the mutual information of A with C with some conditioning, because we've already talked about B. What do we know? Well, one of the constraints is that the first term is zero, and what we've just argued is that the second term is zero. So this mutual information is zero, which means that in this inequality up top, the right-hand side is always zero. And so it's kind of trivially satisfied, but it's satisfied. Right? So we verified this Linden and Winter inequality. Now, just last year, Cadney, Linton, and Winter pushed this further and came up with some new inequalities, and I won't go into much, any detail about these ones. There are fewer constraints and more subsystems. but they're independent of the previous ones, but we can very easily use superextensivity to prove that these inequalities hold also, and in fact, every inequality that has been found also holds. And so this is, again, some kind of consistency check for the Ryu-Takayanagi formula. Now, as I said before, if two is good, three is better. If three is good, four must be better, right? So let's move on to four. And there could be a four-way mutual information, this thing here, where, again, you just use the law of inclusion and exclusion, right? You weight by the number of elements in the set, and you sum over all possible subsets in entropy. And the question would be, does this holographic entanglement, or this Ryu-Takayanagi formula, imply something about this four-way mutual information? And I filled half a notebook with examples, confirming that this thing had to be less than zero, but those picture proofs can, are notoriously misleading. And actually, even in a 1+1-dimensional CFT, you can find counterexamples, and here's a counterexample. It turns out that this is the Poincaré half-disk model of hyperbolic space, that with this particular combination of lengths for the intervals, you get some funny, this is the way that you calculate the entropies for the ones, then the twos, then the threes, and then the fours. This turns out to give you a four-way mutual information that's positive. So it can go either way, and there's nothing that we can say in this case. But this actually motivates, I guess, being a little bit more careful about the proof of the extensivity. Because the way that I showed you a pretty picture to prove extensivity, but it was a very particular configuration of regions, right? I'm not necessarily interested in just talking about three adjacent intervals. I'm not necessarily interested in just talking about intervals. Right? I'm interested in higher dimensional systems, not necessarily connected and so on, right? So we should be more careful about this. And so let's just see how the argument goes. And this is going to be, well, this is going to be sort of a Humpty Dumpty story, right? So Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. The wall happened to be, you know, the boundary of an asymptotically de Sitter, anti-de Sitter spacetime, and he fell into the he fell in, got broken into many pieces, and then got reassembled, but not actually all the king's men and all the king's horses or whatever didn't manage to reassemble him as he was supposed to be reassembled, and that's what we're going to do here. So I'm using slightly different notation than I did before. So I'm going to call the boundary x and the bulk y. And these gammas are going to represent regions in the bulk, okay? And so I'm interested, so if I talk about gamma A, for example, it's a region. So there's a y, there's an x boundary for gamma A, which is A, right? The part of the boundary of gamma A which lies in the boundary theory, but I don't want to talk about boundary, so I'll just say the x part of the boundary. And there's a y part of the boundary, the part of the boundary that lies in the bulk. And what we're interested in doing is minimizing the y part of the boundary. Okay, so in the original proof that I described earlier, the way that it worked is I took these y boundaries and I cut them up and I reassembled them. So we're going to do something, we're going to do the same thing, but in general it's more complicated. So if I take, for example, the region associated with AB, okay? So I'm interested in the left-hand side. Remember, there's originally an AB part, a BC part, and an AB part. So let's look at the AB part. It can intersect with the BC region, it can intersect with the AC region. And one part of the Y boundary is the part of the Y boundary of gamma AB that also intersects the Y boundary, or that also intersects the region BC and also intersects the region AC. Okay? So I've drawn that. There's a part that intersects BC but not AC. There's a part that intersects AC but not BC, and then there's a part that doesn't intersect any of them. So in general, I take this boundary and I break it up into four parts. If you look at the original proof, I took these boundaries and just broke them up into two parts. So in general, you had to break it up into four. You do this for each of gamma BC and gamma AC, so you actually break the bulk surface into 12 different pieces. And then we're going to reassemble them. And the way that we reassemble them is we define bulk regions, and we're going to look at the boundaries of those bulk regions. So let's focus on A, for example. This bulk region gamma tilde of A, I'll take the region associated with AB, the region associated with AC, because they both contain an A part, and then I remove the part that doesn't contain an A. So that's the gamma BC. And I do the same thing for BC, C, and ABC. And then we can ask, with this definition, does the region gamma tilde A terminate on A as it's supposed to? And that's actually a pretty easy thing to do if you just work with this boundary operator. It sort of acts like a derivative in some sense, right? And so the boundary of AB is AB, the boundary of AC is AC, the boundary of BC is BC, and you find that this thing ends on A, just as it's supposed to. Now, if we actually ask about its pieces, right, because we're so we've verified that gamma tilde A terminates on A, but we want to ask, well, what pieces are there associated with that region? Well, its definition, it sort of has three parts to it, and so the boundary gets three parts, right? So the boundary is going to have three different parts, and if we look at what the parts of the boundary are, well, here's one. It's the Y part of the boundary of gamma AB, the part that intersects gamma AC but not BC. Well, that's this guy here. It's gamma, I think, this one. So it's the boundary of AB, the part that intersects AC but not BC. And in general, we're going to have three pieces here for each of the four regions that we've defined. And so they're exactly 12 pieces, and if you write them down, they match up perfectly. Right? So it's really just a set theoretic argument, but you can cut it apart and reassemble it in such a way that you really do properly actually construct the regions satisfying the right homology properties. Okay, so now we can be confident that this proof of superextensivity was not just, you know, us deceiving ourselves by looking at a 1+1-dimensional theory. It's really, you know, it's robust. The title of the talk was monogamy. And I've been using the language of superextensivity all the time. So what is this monogamy all about? Well, in quantum information theory, we like to say that entanglement is monogamous, in the sense that if I have, say, a quantum system or a quantum state on three subsystems, the more entangled A is with B, the less entangled it has to be with C. And in the extreme case, that's just saying that if the state between A and B is a pure entangled state, then it has to factorize with C, right? So that if you are as entangled as you can be between A and B, then you have no entanglement between A and C at all. Right? So that's just monogamy. Now, it manifests itself quantitatively by what we call monogamy relations, which are just superextensivity statements. And I'll give you a couple of examples. You can define something called the one-way entanglement of distillation. So that would be, if I have a density operator on A and B, I allow myself to perform some measurement of B, I send the result to A, and at the end, I perform some local processing, and at the end of the day, I'm supposed to produce Bell pairs. How many Bell pairs can I make? That's called the entanglement of distillation. So the more I distill between A and B, the less I can distill between A and C, given a total budget, which is defined by the total distillable entanglement between A and BC. There's another measure of entanglement called the squashed entanglement that we'll come back to soon that has this same property. And the entanglement of formation, which you may be familiar with, roughly the number of Bell pairs required to make a mixed state, that satisfies a kind of monogamy also, in the sense that the entanglement of formation between A and B plus some other measure of correlation that I won't define in detail between A and C is bounded above by the total entropy of A, sort of how many occupied degrees of freedom there are. And of course, we can compare to the superextensivity property that we proved for mutual information, and of course, these inequalities all have exactly the same form. And so in quantum information, we use this colorful language of monogamy, but what it really is just superextensivity of this correlation measure. And what this suggests, although I don't want to say anything more than it's a suggestion, is that in these holographic field theories, when you evaluate mutual information, that mutual information, what it's detecting, the kind of correlation that it's detecting, might be entanglement. Right, because this correlation has a built-in monogamy character, that's some indication that it might be that what's going on is that you're measuring entanglement. But it's just a suggestion because there are classical distributions that are also monogamous. Right, so entanglement has to be monogamous. Classical distributions can be monogamous. All right. So to end, I'd like to just give you a conjecture. And that's a conjecture that would actually make the statement on the previous slide rigorous. And so if you're feeling energetic or you like these kinds of ideas, then I encourage you to go after this. So I talked about the squashed entanglement on the previous slide, but I didn't define it. So here's the definition. The squashed entanglement between A and B for a state rho, what you're going to do is you're going to evaluate the conditional mutual information for some state sigma. And what state sigma? Well, sigma has to be a state on three subsystems now, A, B, and E, such that when you trace over E, you recover your original state rho. So sigma is just an extension of rho to some other system E. But E can be unbounded in size, right? There's no constraints on what E is, and all possible extensions are possible, are allowed. And so you take the infimum over all possible extensions, that's the squashed entanglement. It's not at all obvious from the definition, but if the state is entangled, this quantity is going to be strictly positive. And if the state is separable, not entangled, then it's going to be zero. So what do we know from a holographic theory? If we take an extension of rho, in which E is actually a spatial region, right? Then the superextensivity property is just saying that the conditional mutual information of AB given E is at least as big as the mutual information. So there was, you know, it didn't do you any good to take this extension, right? That we're taking the inf over extensions here, but you might as well just taken the original mutual information. Of course, that's just some subset of all possible extensions, the ones that actually have this spatial character. But here's a wildly optimistic conjecture. In order to evaluate the inf above, it's sufficient to only consider spatial extensions, potentially with other geometries, but only spatial extensions that have this holographic property. And if that's the case, then the squashed entanglement is exactly equal to 1/2 the mutual information. And what I said in the previous slide is rigorously true. that mutual information is measuring entanglement in the quantum state. But that's essentially all the correlation that's present. It's all in the form of entanglement. Do I believe this? I don't know. I'm agnostic. But come talk to me if you're interested. So what we've managed to do here is I first just reviewed that in general field theories, mutual information can be subextensive, extensive, superextensive. It can do anything. But then we saw that assuming the Ryu Takayanagi formula, mutual information is always superextensive. It's always monogamous. And so this is telling us something interesting, both about the correlation structure of holographic field theories, or if you flip that on its head, it's giving us a way of evaluating the self-consistency of the conjecture. And one last thing that comes out of this, and I guess you know, I'm an information theorist rather than a field theorist, but my field theorist co-authors were very excited because one game that they like to play is if they encounter a field theory, you know, in the wild, then they want to know, does this thing have a holographic dual? Right? They might not know in advance. They kind of have to search, right? And this gives us necessary condition that has to be satisfied if the theory is to have a holographic dual. And just you know, as examples, I drew the table earlier in the talk where I listed a number of field theories. You can just you know, strike a bunch of them off the list right away and say, well, they'll never have holographic duals because they don't satisfy this the superextensivity property. So that's the story, and thank you for your attention.